Hey, everybody, Patrick Connor here, and welcome to the Knuckles and Gloves podcast. Boxing history, my friends, and it's anniversary time. So I'm here with my buddy Aris Pina, CompuBox operator, and just fight history fanatic like myself. Aris, what the hell is up, bro? How are you?
How's everything, my friend?
Doing good, dude. I mean, 25 years. I literally was just saying before we went on and started recording, oh my God. Like, I realized it was a long time ago. I know what year it was. I guess I didn't really put a number to how long ago it was. And holy shit, 25 years ago. So it yesterday was the anniversary. Let's see when I actually get this published. But the 19th of December in 1997, Nassim Hamed versus Kevin Kelly. Dude, I mean, we're revisiting, retelling, reliving yowzas.
Dude, I mean, think about that. Like you said, 1997, if you think about it quickly, you know, you'd be like, oh, it wasn't that long ago. And then you realize that was 25 fucking years ago. That was a long time ago. It was an entirely different world. What was I doing in 1997? I was either in December of that year. I was in either sixth or seventh grade. I don't even remember.
Gosh, dude. I mean, I don't know where. I have absolutely no idea. I was 15. I know I didn't watch it live. I'm pretty sure I didn't watch it live. But, I mean, I knew of Hamed. Everybody knew of Hamed. And, I mean, I think that's something something that's easy to forget. I think for a lot of younger fans especially, and I think probably some fans who are our age or even older, it's easy to forget because, as we were also discussing before we were recording, Nassim Hamed, dude, phenomenon. Absolute fucking cultural, like in commercials, etc. I remember when he got the Adidas deal and it was a massive dude. They had like I don't remember what it was they premiered the commercial on, but it was like an Adidas commercial premiere. And she remember when they used to do that shit in the 90s, dude. You know, they would premiere a fucking commercial. What? Like it was the
it
Super
was something
Bowl.
To the effect of, I remember, it was like the prince is coming. There was some guy yelling and he was talking, just touting them. Yeah.
It was almost like they do like the Big E shit, like on the, yes. But I mean, he was massive, fucking massive. And so, I mean, you know, it's easy because when you bring up Hamed now, literally every fucking person ever goes Barrera, but Barrera. And it's like, dude, you know, it was more to Nassim Hamed's career than Marco Antonio Barrera. So, I mean, that's, and this fight is a big part of his career.
Totally. So, you know, like you just kind of said, man, it's hard to describe how much of a phenomenon Hamed became in the late 90s. I ended up watching this card live with my dad. It was on a Friday night. I was absolutely hyped the entire week for it. And now that I remember, I was actually in sixth grade, going into seventh, but, I was beyond hyped for this card because not only did it feature Hamed against one of my favorites at the time, Kevin Kelly, that the undercard was going to be Junior Jones and Kennedy McKinney. And both of those guys in the mix at that point, when Marco Antonio Barrera had made quite a stir themselves. And this obviously was just a card that was not to be missed. You know what I mean? And I remember specifically one of my friends, because he knew I was gullible, and we were at the Boys and Girls Club that day, and he told me that the card was canceled. And I started believing him because he told me something about Kevin Kelly testing positive for... He made up a drug, and I believed him. I was like, how do you know this? He was like, oh, no, I read it in the paper already. It got canceled. And he was doing that to mess with me. And I was all freaked out, and I remember going home, and I'm, like, scrolling through and telling my dad. My dad was like, what are you talking about? Nothing's being canceled. I was like, yeah, it is. Chris told me. And he was like, you believe in your friends again, Aris? And I'm just like – and then obviously it wasn't. But, like, yeah, man, because when I say a phenomenon that Hamed was, unless you are, you know, fully entrenched as a hardcore boxing fan – you didn't, you know, you weren't realizing what kind of impact he had in the late 90s. You know, it was more just like people were just fascinated by what was going to happen. You know, to surmise him a little bit, like when he first came on the scene in England, people were just hearing rumblings about it. Like you were reading about it in magazines, like the local, like remember the weekly magazine that they used to do, like the little newspaper magazine, like British Boxing Weekly or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Like those type of things. Hamed was already getting write ups in those. He was an amateur sensation, and coming from the Brendan Ingle camp, he had a style that hadn't been seen since the days of a prime Harold Graham. And not only that, unlike Graham, he was carrying one punch knockout power as a featherweight, junior featherweight at this point. He wasn't even a featherweight. And so...
But important to note that also Harold Graham was also from the Brendan Ingle camp.
Yeah, that's so what I meant to say. There's that whole tie-in. Exactly. And so by the time Hamed started making inroads and like started being mentioned, like as, for instance, as a new face in Ring Magazine and just popping up in different blotters and stuff like that, you know, people were getting curious. Oh, who is this kid? Oh, he's knocking the hell out of people left and right in Europe and never going rounds. And you're seeing photos of him with this unusual herky jerky looking style. But unless you were like a tape trader back then or something, there was nothing to be seen. Remember, this is the days before social media. There was no YouTube. There was no nothing. We were just kind of, you know, left out to dust with him. As I became a fan, I started reading about him, became more and more curious, hoping I was able to catch a glimpse of him one day. Because as I'm reading about him, he's knocking out this guy, that one. Finally, he's matched up with Steve Robinson, who at the time was a WBO featherweight champion. You know, have we discussed on the show, Pat, before how featherweight champ, you know, how the WBO was randomly and whatever, how it was respected in America, yada, yada, yada. In Europe, it always seemed to hold a certain place where it always like held a certain pedestal over there. Way before America really like took grasp of it, Europe already was like, you know, acknowledging it more or less. You know what I mean? If the champion was a WBO champion, they definitely were more, you know, accommodating and commanding and yada, yada, yada. So Steve Robinson was a long time featherweight champion, came from humble beginnings, a really good fighter and a respected fighter. Hamed took him apart, just demolished him. It wasn't even competitive in that fight. And there's a famous photo that I saw in the Boxing Illustrated magazine that made me want to see Hamed so badly fight. And that was Steve Robinson on all fours with his head down after he got dropped and Hamed standing over him and with his mouth open like Muhammad Ali looking down. And I was like, I have to see this guy one day, you know? So that's what the type of stir that Hamed was creating at this point in the mid to late 90s.
A lot of the fighters that he was defeating, like, I mean, another thing about the WBO, especially then, that it's changed a little bit, but not that much. But apart from it being kind of known as something of a European or European-centric or organization or whatever, which is weird because I'm pretty sure even then it was based out of Venezuela. I don't know. Puerto Rico? Sorry, it's Puerto Rico, I think.
Okay.
I don't know. In any case, it's not based out of Europe, to my knowledge. But in any case, another thing is that they've always been very weird about whether or not they're going to enforce mandatories. They're super selective about it. You know, like, and for instance, one of the mandatories that had popped up for Nassim Hamed over the years was Juan Manuel Marquez. And that was a fight that had been talked about in the ring a number of different times and a few different issues and whatnot, until finally it was just kind of accepted, or at least the line was that like Hamed just didn't want to fight him or was avoiding him or something like that. And I mean, I guess, but it was also in part Marquez's fault because of, you know, he was having difficulty staying consistent, blah, blah, blah.
Very, but, very.
But for whatever reason, Hamed seemed really loyal to this WBO belt. I don't know if it was some sort of lineage he liked or something. I never really understood it, because he was taking on champions from other organizations and defeating them, but just not hanging on to the belts, I guess. But around that time, he was defeating a string of opponents that most of them were not super well known in the U.S., partially because of the weight class, but some of them because they weren't American fighters. And so you know what happens when that happens, when it comes to like American press and shit like that. Then that means that fighter ain't shit. You know, that means that they're beating a bunch of bullshit fighters or a bunch of bums or something. That's always how it goes. Mm-hmm. But in reality, a number of these fighters actually were very good. I mean, even Manuel Medina, I know that he was not... like, you know, he was spotty himself, but he would give just about any fighter a tough night on his best night.
He gave Hamed fits that night.
He was a slippery bastard. And so Hamed fought some pretty good fighters is the point. I mean, I know it's easy to say otherwise, but he did.
But here's the thing, Pat. So after he wins the title, Hamed now, we're in 1995, he knocks out Steve Robinson. He makes one title defense first against a no-hoper against Saeed Lowell, who gets knocked out in less than a minute. And that was the beauty of Hamed, that like if he could catch you early and flatten you, he would immediately. So after that, like I told you, after reading about him beating Steve Robinson, I was drooling, literally salivating as a little kid, because this was me. I was in the boxing. I wasn't in the basketball, football, stuff like that. Like, I followed boxing religiously. And I wanted to see Hamed fight on television. And then randomly one day, and this is the beauty of kind of being a fan back in the day, sometimes you would get surprised without even knowing it. Hamed was going to make his U.S. debut. Not U.S. and the actual states, but U.S. television debut on Showtime against a fighter by the name of Daniel Alessia, who was an undefeated prospect at the time. And I remember at that night, I was expecting to watch Terry Norris against Julio Cesar Vasquez. And like either that day or the day before, one of those guys pulled out for one reason or another. And Hamed Alessia ends up becoming the main event slot for that fight. And I was like, oh, shit, okay, this is exciting. I get to see Hamed for the first time. And I remember being fascinated by his entrance, because it reminded me of like something you'd see in WWF back then, or WCW, whatever, you know, and his whole demeanor. Like, he has people walking him down the ring. Like, if you were the king of the ring back in the day, for instance, like King Harley Race or King Macho King. You know, and you have the four people holding you up, and he's there sitting there and doing this and all that. And he's like, stop. He's like, the prince wants to walk now. And they let him down. And he comes in, he does the whole flip in the air and all that shit. And then I see him fight, and he's doing the same herky jerky style I'm seeing in photos. Now I'm actually watching it live. And then he gets dropped because he's so off balance and so wonky. Alessia catches him with a beautiful right hand, and Hamed gets dropped. But then he comes right back and flattens Alessia. Like, and it wasn't like, you know, oh, hit him with a flurry and the referee jumped in. No, he hit him so hard, the poor dude bounced his head off like a basketball and just laid there stiffened and unconscious. And that's when I was hooked, line and sinker. I was like, I got to watch every fight I can of him, you know? And soon after that, luckily enough, Showtime again, they aired the Manuel Medina fight. And Medina was another guy that I've read about a lot in the magazines, but didn't really get a chance to see because he wasn't, you know, featured or televised when I was in my infancy that often, right? So when he's fighting on Showtime, I remember specifically because for whatever reason, I think he had the same designed trunks that Hamed had, really crazy frizzies and stuff like that. But like you said, Pat, man, very wily veteran, giving Hamed all kinds of tricks and slipping and sliding. Good, tough fight till Hamed eventually broke through and stopped him. But you just knew you were watching the guy that was on the rise. If he wasn't special to you yet, he was about to be, and just someone that he was must-see television.
Yeah, it became clear, I think, pretty quickly watching him that it was like he was all in one way or another. You know, he was either going to get knocked out in spectacular fashion, or he was going to contort and mm-hmm. twist and leap and do all sorts of crazy shit to try to knock his opponents out. And we've talked about the greatest punchers, and he was one of those punchers where it didn't really look like you didn't know where the power came from. You know, he was kind of lengthy. Like, he did have pretty good reach, but it was, he didn't really use his reach like that though. Like, you know, he wasn't like snapping punches.
He wasn't especially tall or anything. He had really thick calves, like Pacquiao types.
Yeah, he was, and he was mostly like leaping with his shit. Like, he wasn't really like a, you know, precision puncher like that, you know, like a textbook puncher. And so, yeah, it became clear that it was one way or another, you know, you were going to get a show. And he became very quickly, I think even in the UK, but probably to a lesser extent, he was probably more beloved in the UK than anything. But the act in the US was like, people love to hate that shit in the US. Americans love to hate that kind of shit, you know, especially if it's somebody foreign.
Yeah.
Like, they're just like, oh, no way, not here, you know? They're crazy about that shit.
And that's what the U.S. fans are waiting for. Now we're starting to get a taste of him because we're starting to see him on U.S. television. He's being featured on Showtime. This was during the time where Don King, his strength and hold on Showtime is being broken a little bit because Frank Warren is starting to get his guys on, you know, random shows. Hence why Hamed was featured on like that. And Hamed's last fight on Showtime was a dominant performance against Tom Johnson, a long time, very underrated featherweight champion. And it was a unification fight. Like you said, Hamed beat a lot of the other champions, but always held on to that WBO belt. You know, if he gave up the other one, whatever. And so Johnson, who was a little bit longer in the tooth at this point, gave Hamed some issues too. I mean, it was a good fight, but Hamed clearly was, you know, a step above until he eventually stopped him. But at that point, it was at that point that everybody just kind of knew, all right, now the time was to make the move. And he's been featured on Showtime and American television, but now the time was to make the move to actual America and fight on HBO. Because I'm sure, as you can agree as well, even though Showtime, you know, was a prominent broadcaster for boxing at that point, there was clearly still number two compared to HBO. And if you ask most fans back then, especially casual ones, who when they watch boxing, they would say, oh, yeah, I watch it on HBO. You know, so it was essential that if Hamed was going to make an impact, he was going to have to switch networks and America.
No question. And also on top of that, 1996 saw the first show of Boxing After Dark.
Yes. And as we're about to get to with the undercard now and talk how that all ties in.
So clearly HBO was, well, and on top of that, HBO was affiliated with the other. I mean, Mike Tyson at this time was obviously very volatile and nobody knew what the fuck was happening with a lot of that stuff. Or at this point, he was probably just on his way to being suspended or having his license suspended and shit like that. But he was the biggest moneymaker. And then also HBO had a number of these other fighters like Oscar De La Hoya, Felix Trinidad. I know that there was a lot in flux with that and shit like that, but he was primarily Showtime, at least for the time being. But HBO was building a momentum for sure. And this was another example of that, embracing the lower weight classes and doing it in a way where, like, hey, you know, maybe we can make something out of this. Maybe we can mix and match some of these fighters up. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you'll talk about that in a couple minutes too. But, you know, with these potential matchups down the road as well, with some of these, like, you know, 130-pound fighters that we got and 135-pound fighters that we got. So, you know, there was definitely some interesting programming that HBO was thinking about in their boxing programming right around this time. And yeah, I think that Nassim Hamed was becoming like a business. You know, he was a phenomenon. He was more than just a fighter. And what's that documentary they did for the Barrera fight? It's like a Little Prince Big Fight or something like that, I want to say.
Oh, dude, I am not going to lie to you. Besides highlights, I have not watched Barrera Hamed since it first happened, nor have I watched any of the anything else. The only thing I've seen are just like where everybody repeats the same thing of Hamed getting his head knocked into the corner. I just never really thought about watching it again. A lot of fights I just never thought watching again. That was just one of them for whatever reason.
Well, they like a documentary crew. I say it for a reason, I swear. A documentary crew was following Nassim Hamed around for that fight. And I know I'm skipping a lot of time here, but the point is just that I think that documentary illustrated just how popular he'd become and just also how much like he'd kind of bought into his own hype and his own legend or whatever. And this was that legend building. Or, you know, back in 1996, 97, that was almost kind of like when you would hear Hamed in interviews or read Hamed in interviews, he talked a lot about like it was his destiny and his destiny was to like rule over the featherweight division. And then he was going to move up and then he was going to move up to 130 pounds and rule over that division. And nobody was going to be able to stop him. Talked a lot about religion, et cetera, et cetera. And so it sounded like he was making it come true. I mean, like at this point, it seemed like there was really no stopping him. It was actually pretty interesting too, because like I said, American fans were loving to hate on his ass. Mm-hmm. And this presented, you know, against Kevin Kelly, Nassim Hamed had already fought four times in 1997. So he's closing out in December of 1997. He's closing out the year with a firefight against a dude.
Yes.
Go ahead.
I don't know, but I was going to say, it's like, you couldn't pick a better opponent for Hamed's American debut at Madison Square Garden and on HBO. Like, I get goosebumps thinking about it again, you know what I mean? Because, like, it was just the perfect storm that you can think of. Kevin Kelly, as you just mentioned, Pat, was just one of those guys that, like, when he first burst onto the scene, you know, former, always a New York fighter through and through, like, a stellar amateur career that culminated almost making the 88 Olympic team. And after he fell through on that, he turns pro and becomes a local hero in the New York area. First off, you know, turning pro and then fighting multiple times in the Felt Forum. Like a lot of the prospects in the New York area used to do all the time, right? Because that was just the place to fight at. You know, gaining experience, and this is the late 80s. So people are still keeping a high work rate in terms of, like, activity out in the ring. Like, they're fighting, especially early in your career, it's not uncommon for you to be fighting 7, 8, 9 times a year or something like that. Clearly, that does not happen now at all, but back in Kelly's prime in the late 80s, early 90s, this was a common thing. The only thing that was holding him back was his size. You know what I mean? Most guys, especially Americans, were not the size of, you know, not featherweights. 126 pounds or 122 at junior featherweight, yada, yada, yada. And it's always been the sense that these guys have always been held back too. You know what I mean? That, you know, on certain networks, everything, if you're going to, sometimes you'll see a junior feather, back then you'll see a junior featherweight title fight or another one like that, but it would always be buried on a pay-per-view card or anything. You didn't see anything clearly featured on HBO or on Showtime. Correct me if I'm wrong. I think before Kelly finally convinced Lou DiBella to get his title fight with Goyo Vargas, Goyo Vargas, who a longtime champ, tough champion himself, televised. The last time a featherweight title fight happened was Salvador Sanchez against, like, Jorge Rocky Garcia in the early 80s. You know what I mean?
If something else did happen, I can't name it off the top of my head. That's for sure.
Exactly. So that was the start of it. And, like, Kelly having to come off, you know, having to come off the canvas against Vargas, outbox him, everything like that. And win a very, very good decision in a fight, and, you know, becomes champion. So now you got an exciting style. You got a guy who has good power, great boxing skills, and can talk his ass off, because Kelly was a loudmouth, you know? And he was a very good promoter too. Like, the dude just knew how to build himself up. That's how he convinced Lou to get him on. And once he became champion, he starts becoming, like, you know, an HBO staple, so to speak. And they're about to give him, like, a long contract with a bunch of, like, you know, multiple fights if he can get through some stuff. So first he fights Jesse Benavidez, another completely forgotten contender from the 80s and early 90s. And in a firefight that Kelly, again, has to come off the canvas to win, he does win that. But he's a favorite now. And so by the time he fights Alejandro Gonzalez in 1995, or was it like 94, 95, around that time, it was another show I watched live with my dad. And that was one of those early fights in my boxing fandom that, like, made me go absolutely apeshit. Like, you've seen that fight, Pat. It's incredible. You know, Gonzalez and Kelly. Gonzalez was completely unknown.
Yeah, Kelly Cobrita.
Cobrita, yes. Kelly, you know, was the proven commodity, fought multiple times on HBO and was popular for a low-weight fighter. And Cobrita was just a beast that night. Came in just churning and churning and wouldn't stop. And Kelly, who had notoriously bad eyes and would, you know, constantly swell, started puffing up, started getting beat up and everything like that. And a couple of key moments in the fight, I just remember that made me just like, wow, this is absolutely incredible what I'm watching. Gonzalez was beating the shit out of Kelly a few times. It looked like the fight was going to get stopped. Kelly comes back, scores a dramatic-ass knockdown. Boom! Gonzalez goes down. Literally bushwhacked of just what happened to him, because he was in control of the fight and he doesn't, like, you see his eyes and he's kind of like, wait, whoa. And then dramatically gets on one knee and crosses himself before he gets up, because he's just like, holy crap, like, you know, things just got real. And then he goes back into war. Like, you know, it's beautiful shit like that. And it's just like, you know,
Kelly's eye was all fucked up. And I mean, in today, they probably would have stopped that like a couple rounds earlier. But totally. I mean, you know, he got his chance and it was bad.
But it was an incredible fight that's still remembered by hardcores like us. And then the main event was Wilfredo Vasquez, a longtime underappreciated former bantamweight and junior featherweight champion, defending his crown, against Orlando Canizales, one of the longest reigning bantamweight champions in history. So at that point, this was the first time that it looked like the networks were really embracing the lower weight fighters because they were featuring them in two prominent fights like this. So this is what the momentum was going. This was the wave that was going to end up propelling us to where we ended up getting with Hamed and Kelly.
Yeah, and it's still, we talked about it recently on the most recent episode about Noya Inoue and his path up to bantamweight and whatnot, and how it's still kind of a struggle to get promoters and networks and apps or whatever to feature the lower weight fighters. But finally, you know, there was some breakthrough in the late 90s here. And when they finally matched Nassim Hamed and Kevin Kelly, Hamed's fight right before that, and I posted about this on the boxing history account just because I was thought it was funny. It was just hilarious the way that Hamed talked fucking trash, because it was like, it was aggravating. I would have been annoyed by it too if I were Kevin Kelly, bro, for real. But like, so
he, voice too.
Yeah, Madison Square Garden.
You and Mickey's facing that too, that he just knew he was getting you fucking riled up because
he knew it. He absolutely 100 with his massive ears and his getting in your face and his little haircut. He knew it. But like, so he beats Jose Badillo. And that's probably, they had it under contract for him to fight Kevin Kelly. And this is on Sky where he fights Jose Badillo. And you know how they still do this shit on a lot of the UK broadcasts where they have the fighter go sit down on the apron and they interview him on the apron. I don't know. I mean, I don't have a problem with it. It's just, it's funny because it's like almost stereotypical at this point. So they have Kevin Kelly ringside too. And they're kind of like, you know, interviewing Hamed and he's blah, 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 talking shit. And he's like laughing at himself because it's like he can't even keep a straight face half the time when he's talking shit, you know, because he's such a goofball. And so then they bring over Kevin Kelly to sit down and he just starts yapping in Kevin Kelly's ear. And he's like, whoa, relax, relax. And you could hear Kevin Kelly go like, you relax. he's like, no, dude, I'm done with your shit, bro. It's fucking pretty funny. And so you could see it. I don't know how many people in the U.S. even saw that at the time. Probably very, very few. But still, I would have, if I were in the U.K. and saw that, that would have gotten me like, yeah, let's get this shit going. But Kevin Kelly, you know, even just from a stylistic point of view, tends to be in fun fights.
Yeah.
Good punching power. Good technician. Won the New York Golden Gloves twice in the mid 80s. You know, he was a very good fighter. He wasn't like he was just some unknown dude. He had a lot of style and class. It was, I think there was a question as to like, was he past it? Because he was a few years past winning the title.
And he struggled. He definitely struggled in those years. And that's what I was about to say is that really quickly is that after he lost to Gonzalez, you know, it looked like for a minute he was cooked. You know what I mean? Like he did not look good in his subsequent fights for a little while. He fights a guy named Ricardo Rivera, which by all accounts is one of those Lee Groves closet classics, as we like to call them. And he got dropped a couple of times. He struggled in that one. He fights Bones Adams, which I remember watching. I think that was on pay-per-view, and that fight sucked.
Dude, Bones Adams, I'm sorry, but he was absolute NyQuil sometimes, most of the time.
Yeah, and unless he was fighting Paulie Aiello, who just forced you to be in a good fight.
He would just throw punches relentlessly until you threw him back.
Exactly. So, I mean, but yeah, that just fight was not made for the weak of heart. And if everybody talks about John Ruiz fights to fall asleep to, go ahead. I guarantee you, if you've never seen Kevin Kelly, Bones Adams, you'll be gone by round four. Promise you that. So, but this is where I was looking. You know what made Kevin Kelly, though, like what ended up propelling him eventually to the Hamed fight was the Derek Gaynor fight. His first fight with Derek Gaynor.
Derek Gaynor, bro. The Roy Jones Jr.'s little cousin, or not literally, but just, you know, Roy Jones was always toting him around on his undercards, man.
I mean, you know something? Get you a friend who takes care of you like Roy used to take care of Derek Gaynor.
And it was just like, nobody asked to see him. Nobody wanted to see it. Nobody really, you know, no. With all due respect. But God damn it, they were going to keep putting that shit on TV. But no, that was also, in my opinion, for that reason, satisfying too, because Gaynor was so frustrating to watch. He was the kind of fighter that would, like, if a fight was breaking out, no, it wasn't. He'd make sure it was not. He was going to stifle you and hold you and run from you and dip and whoa, and do all sorts of shit to make sure no action. And like, you know, Kevin Kelly, his face again falling apart. Wasn't that another one where his eye was all messed up and then out of nowhere he just goes boop and fucking hits Gaynor?
Well, his eye was completely closed. I'm shocked. Again, it's one of those fights that there's no way this fight happened in 96. There's no way that this fight would be, let alone continue today. That doctor would see his eye completely shut and just be like, nah, not a chance.
Yeah, dude, it's for that reason it was satisfying. Similar to how when Gaynor was getting some traction again a couple of years later, and Juan Manuel Marquez just damn near ran him out of the ring. Also satisfying.
Well, that was one of the worst fights ever aired.
It was terrible. Just the result was satisfying.
I think Gaynor would win that fight.
A lot of people did, dude. You know what? A lot of people did, because, like I said, he had a really frustrating style.
Yeah, you know.
But God, he was scared to death of Marquez. He was just like, ah, get me out of here.
But that was what propelled him to get, you know, to the Hamed fight, because, like, for a while, he was just toiling. Like, the Derek Gaynor fight out of those years was the only one that made it to HBO. Other than that, like you said, he was fighting on the undercard of pay-per-view shows or on like ESPN or something like that. You know, he had to build himself back. This wasn't like being a welterweight or a middleweight, heavyweight, where you lose one and immediately can go right back on HBO and, you know, do something like that. No, you know, he had to build himself back. He had that. And he also had a fight. I'm looking at his box record really quick against Edwin Santana. That was on the early days of Boxing After Dark. That fight sucked too. All right. That was one of the first duds that HBO actually aired on Boxing After Dark, after like the string of impressive fights that they had. You knew a dud was coming eventually, and that was the one. So, you know, Kelly had to prove himself after he had to build himself back up. So he did deserve that Ahmed fight. And putting it at Madison Square Garden was perfect, because you knew there was going to be, like you said, a lively atmosphere that was going to be calling for Ahmed's head, because New York fans are ruthless and they're going to go very hard for their own. And especially for an obnoxious idiot like Ahmed, as people perceived him to be, they were just going to want to see the prince get his comeuppance.
100%, dude. Yeah, 100%. It was the kind of card that actually, you know, when I looked at this card, so we'll talk about the co-feature in just a sec, but I never really bothered looking at the whole event, the entire card, and looking at it, it had Yoan Guzman when he was 1-0 opening up the card, Ricky Hatton when he was 1-0 right after that, Charles Shufford, who of course later on would turn into more of a, you know, kind of fringe journeyman type, but he was 6-0. David Telesco in his younger years, Jason Papillon, remember that guy? Danny Williams, he was 11-0. Michael Clark when he was still undefeated.
Wow, that's a blast from the past.
I'm pretty sure he was a Golden Gloves winner at some point too, and he was on like the
contender as well.
Yeah, that's true. Many years later, for sure. So I mean, like, it was, I'm not saying it was like a blockbuster, which was not like, you know, King in his prime card type of thing going on.
It didn't need to be. You went there for the co-feature, like you said, we're about to mention, and the main event.
But there was a lot of fights on it, so at least people probably got their money's worth. But then, yeah, between the co-feature and the main event, dude, like the, I guess we'll break and we'll talk about the co-feature real quick if that's cool. But
of course, yeah.
I mean, it was.
That's its own whole backstory too, you know.
Yeah, I mean, McKinney. Well, and it ties into what we're talking about too. Like we said, we were talking about Boxing After Dark and all that type of shit. You know, Kennedy McKinney. He goes back farther, even obviously, to the 1984 Olympics is when really, what's that?
88.
I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. 88. The 88 Olympics when he won gold. And, you know, Roy Jones also should have won gold on that team. Let's see, Ray Mercer on that team. You know, I mean, it's a, yeah, it's a number of fairly famous fighters on that team and et cetera. But, you know, Kennedy McKinney, I guess, between being in a somewhat tough division, but also his own personal demons, dude, you know, he had a really tough career and a tough time as an adult. You know, he was a very troubled dude. And I mean, so between the, what was it? I think it was the first fight, because they fought twice, Welcome and Sita.
Yeah.
I mean, absolute fucking war.
Their first fight is one of my all-time favorite fights, and it is criminally underrated today. But, like, you know, unless you're hardcore is like us, but I mean, it was just, that's one of Cedric's, my old boss, Cedric Kushner, one of the best fights he ever promoted. You know, Welcome Nita, however you want to pronounce it, was junior featherweight champion, South African dude back in the late 80s, early 90s. And what I like the most about him is that, like, you know, he was a young brass champion who's a highly skilled guy, but sometimes would fight to the level of his opposition. He would struggle, like, you know, in fights that he should dominate and he wouldn't. And you would wonder, like, you know, where his consistency would be at. He also had a really cool ass high top fade, so I was always just a fan of that. But regardless, he stepped it up to, like, he fought the performance of his life in the first fight with McKinney. And he was dominant. Well, I don't want to say dominating, but he was clearly in command in the fight. And if the fight was held in the US, I think it would be, like, remembered more fondly. But Cedric had a tendency to hold a lot of his title fights in various, like, you know, exotic locations. And I don't remember off the top of my head, because I'm not looking at it, where this one was held, but it definitely was not held in America. It was either Italy or, like, Tunisia or somewhere out there. And but regardless of all that, Nita was putting on a clinic. And I think it was around round 11, as you said, that, like, when he was about to finish him, McKinney gets hurt by a combination, turns his back and goes down on a knee. And he's, like, clearly in distress and hurt. And then as Nita comes in to finish him, McKinney throws his right hand, wow, just blast him, and brings home the title.
Yeah, it was like Last Chance Saloon, dude. It was the last, you know. And actually, Steve Smoger was the referee of that fight in Italy.
Really?
You're right. Oh, yeah,
it was in Italy. Okay. Yeah,
yeah. And Steve Smoger, so I mean, that kind of makes a little extra sense as to why the fight was allowed to go on.
True.
But yeah,
most referees would stop it, because the way McKinney turned his back, like, that was a sign of surrender. He turned his back and went down and just crumbled himself, you know.
Yeah, and somehow he mustered, you know, the strength to throw that one last shot that put the dude out. It was just absolutely brutal, dude. And I mean, but I think that it was already clear that it was shit was starting to crumble for him. He was having difficulty keeping it together. He was having a tough time keeping his performances consistent. I can't remember right off the top of my head. I'm pretty sure it was cocaine, right? That he was, yes.
Yeah,
that he kept cocaine. Getting into,
yeah.
Like cocaine and alcohol. And so, I mean, it's a simple fact, dude, that pretty much anybody at the higher level of boxing, you just can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you, at least not for a sustained period of time, you know, you just can't do it. It's going to take a toll on your career. And so that's pretty much what wound up happening with Kennedy McKinney. But, you know, he, even after, you know, these ups and downs in the early to mid 90s, kind of redeemed himself. Mm-hmm. And when we were talking about Boxing After Dark, despite the fact that he lost, you know, well, actually, we can even go a little bit farther than that. Like, he had a couple of kind of redemptive arcs over the course of his career. But, well, I mean, whatever. I guess going to the Barrera fight, because he was somewhat inactive. Boxing After Dark, massive platform. They were starting this platform on HBO. Marco Antonio Barrera himself was kind of like, you know, wavering back and forth himself. How many times did he resurrect his career? You know what I mean? But they were kind of like, all right, Lou DiBella put together this this show on HBO that was like, all right, well, if it's not championship level, or if we don't have a world title on the line, we can still feature these fights that are really interesting, or stylistically the fights that people would want to see, and they're still high level. It's just that, you know, I guess we're not going to call it the championship, whatever. So it was Boxing After Dark. And so I think that was the outlook for Kennedy McKinney, was that he needed a chance. Marco Antonio Barrera needed a chance. And even though Marco Antonio Barrera wound up winning and triumphantly, Kennedy McKinney, the showing was kind of like enough to demonstrate that he wasn't done, you know, that he still had a little bit of spark in him, and that he fought hard, and that he did everything that he could. He kept getting up. You know, he got knocked down, what, 4 or 5 times in that fight, and he kept getting up. It was just the last one was too much. So, I mean, going into this undercard fight, Kennedy McKinney and Junior Jones.
I mean, so after McKinney loses to Barrera, like you said, he, even though he loses, he kind of resurrected and brought a lot, you know, lightning back to his career, because he was faltering for a bit. He lost his title to Vianney Bungu, which was the Rings upset of the year. And he was just kind of withering on the vine. But after he beats Barrera, that was just like, holy shit. People were just like, you know, that was one of the best fights I had ever seen up to that point in my life. I lost my voice. My dad lost his voice. Everybody was going crazy watching that. And that, you know, you couldn't have asked for a better start to HBO's Boxing After Dark. And you couldn't have had a better boost for the lower weight fighters, too, to show that they deserved a fucking chance to be shown on television and be featured prominently, as opposed to, like, you know, always saying, okay, if I'm going to show a lower weight fight, it has to be lightweight at a minute at the lowest or something like that. Like, these guys were showing them, like, hey, we deserve the airtime, too, and we're some of the best fighters in the world, and we can put on the best fights in the world, you know, some of the best fights you can watch. But McKinney, even after that, like, he struggled for a bit. He didn't look that great in his subsequent fights. I remember the Nestor Lopez fight that was on a Boxing After Dark undercard, I believe. And he looked like crap in that fight. That wasn't a fight he looked good in. He almost lost it. He loses a rematch to Bungu. And again, after that, he fights Hector Acero Sanchez, who was a former, super bantamweight champion himself, and a general pain in the ass to anyone he had to fight. Like, Hector Acero Sanchez made everybody look bad. So McKinney wasn't looking too hot, as you know, when he was moving into his chance against Junior Jones. The opposite now can be said about Junior Jones. Junior Jones, another person, came from the same thing, late 80s, early 90s, long time amateur and everything like that, and very popular in New York City. And when he first burst on, man, like, people were giving him comparisons to, like, Tommy Hearns and stuff as a bantamweight, because look at his dimensions. He was tall, he was lanky, had the same kind of like arm's length, and he was just knocking the shit out of everybody too. Like, he was a spectacular fighter. So by the time he ends up winning the title against Jorge Eliezer Julio, who was a very solid champion, people were looking at Jones and, you know, potentially thinking of him as like pound for pound, because that's how good he looked. And, you know, there was just no one had seen an American bantamweight that solid and that good since the days of Jeff Chandler. You know what I mean? So it was like, people were very, very high on Jones. And then by the time he ends up fighting, and he loses the title now in a huge upset to a guy he had beat earlier in his career, actually, John Michael Johnson. And, you know, if you remember Johnson, he was a Texas fighter from the Tony Ayala senior camp. You know, unspectacular, but he could punch like a motherfucker. You know what I mean? Considering what he did later on a few against guys later on. But, like, anyways, at this point, this was not supposed to happen. Jones was outboxing him, winning the fight mostly. I think this was on the undercard of Holyfield and Michael Moore. But he gets spent. He just, you know, gets exhausted, and Johnson scored a knockout. And instead of, like, you know, people were just like, oh, okay, you know, it was an upset, but we'll see how he comes back. Nah, it looked like Junior Jones completely fell apart after that. Because soon after that, in, like, his second comeback fight or so, he fights a guy by the name of Darryl Pickney. Darryl Pickney back then was one of those journeymen with a .500 record, but he was tough as shit. Very good fighter. I'm going to say a very good fighter, but a tough-as-nails fighter who could punch. And if he didn't come in prepared, he could surprise you. And that's exactly what happened to Jones, because he got flattened by Pickney. And at that point, everybody thought Jones was done. Like, you know, there's no resurrecting him after that, like, whatever. But to his credit, he built himself back up. And he built himself back up enough to where he was able to get an undercard slot against Orlando Canizales. A very, very good matchup on the early days of the Boxing After, the second Boxing After Dark show. And, you know, that's one of those fights, Pat, that, like, I tell people, everybody mentions, you know, like James Toney, Mike McCallum, or other fights like that, that you should watch for technical skill. You should watch Junior Jones and Orlando Canizales. It is, shit is beautiful. They're playing chess against each other. The counters, the counter counters, the feints, the movements. There, so much thinking is going on in there, and it's a beautiful fight to watch, but Jones clearly wins it. And at that point, that brings him to where we're going to, I'll bring it to you now, his first fight with Marco Antonio Barrera.
It's crazy, too, because the Orlando Canizales fight, Junior Jones, like, in almost any interview you can find, you ask and they say, like, everybody wants to talk about the Marco Antonio Barrera fights, but in my opinion, the Orlando Canizales fight was me at my best. Like, that was me looking at my best and, you know, performing my best. That was my best performance. And it was a damn good performance against another fighter, where he said, Junior Jones said that he had been wanting to fight Orlando Canizales for a while. And I mean, you could see why, because Orlando Canizales is kind of guy who is super sharp, moved really well, flashy, you know, just highly skilled. And he wanted a crack at him.
And they were champions at the same time in the division. That's why.
And he said he wound up not getting the opportunity to fight him as a champion. So he fought him later on after they had already moved to 122 pounds. And he said that he thought that was his best performance. But I mean, he kind of just kept plugging away. And he, for the most part, was defeating. He was just kind of racking up wins. Like you said, that was part of kind of a redemption or a comeback for him. And then at that point, Marco Antonio Barrera, 43-0, he had fought at the Forum like a dozen times. You know, he was super popular in Southern California and in Mexico. And he was supposedly one of the favorites at HBO. He was a fighter that HBO really liked, or that HBO really wanted to embrace or whatever. And so they had him matched with Junior Jones. Like, they were kind of like, all right, Junior, you know, this is your chance. And Junior Jones, according to him, you know, he talked a lot of trash because he always felt he could win. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's one of those bigger upsets in the mid-90s, where Barrera was definitely not expected to lose that fight whatsoever. Not, you know, not like, much less just get kind of sunned and absolutely fucking whooped, and then have his corner step in for him, you know, with the weeping and the,
you know. Oh yeah, and the guy throwing a wet sponge at Jones.
Yeah, like
Barrera got cooked.
Like, bro, you come on, just help your guy. Don't embarrass him, too. Goddamn, you know, that's not quite on the level, but approaching the level of homie carrying Tommy Hearns away from Marvin Hagler. Like, bro, let the stretcher take him if it's like that. Like, goddamn it. You know, it was bad, dude. And it was, you know, bad sportsmanship and et cetera. But it was a big upset. It was a real big upset.
It was huge. I mean, like you said, Barrera was on top of the world at this point. He had the McKinney fight, and then he had fun on HBO subsequently, you know, a few times after that. He knocked out Jesse Benavidez, I think was on a pay-per-view. He beat the hell out of a guy by the name of Jesse Magana, who was a popular Southern California fighter in the mid-90s. And yeah, there was nobody that was going to be able to touch Barrera. It was, when it came to the lower weights, the junior featherweights, everything like that, it started with Barrera, and then there was everybody below him. Eric Morales at this point hadn't become champion yet. Daniel Zaragoza was thought not to be a champ, you know, not to be a threat to Barrera. Hamed was still toiling in England, and you know, there was magazines that discussed the possibility of them fighting, but at that point, it was still a crapshoot that no one thought would happen. So, yeah, you know, Barrera was that dude. And Junior Jones, like we said, he had come back from a long winning streak now and built himself back up, and he had the Canizales win that he was building off of. At that point, still, everybody thought that Barrera would still steamroll him. And, you know, the Barrera that we ended up watching, like the complete fighter, the boxer puncher that he became, from the Hamed fight, from the Jesus Salud fight before that, you know, stuff like that, so on. That wasn't the Barrera that was still the seek and destroy guy from the early in the mid-90s that he was, that didn't mind taking a punch or so before he went in there and waited away. And so Jones was able to capitalize on that, you know, land those right hands, right hand after right hand after right hand, and Barrera had no answer for them shits, like, you know. And so, not to say Barrera didn't do any damage, he landed some good body shots here and there, but Jones was just quicker than him, had better, you know, and everything. And then when he finally dropped him, it was right there. And you saw the blood coming down, Barrera just looking bewildered. And yeah, huge upset.
Yeah, it was only what, like the fifth or sixth round, and it looked like it was like the ninth or tenth. Like he was like, he looked a little beat up for what it was, you know? Mm-hmm. And so it was clear though that he it was a big upset. And so in the tradition of stubborn bastards, Barrera said, run that shit back. And actually, I think it was the WBO. The WBO ordered an immediate rematch. Yeah. And I would imagine Barrera probably wanted it because he wouldn't have fought if he didn't want it. But so they ran it back, and it was a far more competitive fight. Marco Antonio Barrera showed why years later you should never count him out in pretty much any fight. And that he is a supreme technician and the kind of fighter who can learn from performances and stuff like that. You know, some cards did score the rematch for him. I don't think that was the kind of fight that he won personally. I thought Junior Jones just kind of outsped him and outdid him a little bit. But regardless, Barrera did much better. He obviously improved in the rematch, no question.
Absolutely, but like you said, Jones definitely won that fight. It was a close, it was a very close fight, but Jones, you know, was the superior guy in it. And building off of that momentum, again, Jones now was back at where, surprisingly, was back where he was when he was bantamweight champion, if not even more so now. Like, people had him on, not only was he on a pound-for-pound list, I remember specifically, like, he was actually high up. It wasn't like he was around 9 or 10. Like, people had him at, like, number 6, number 5. Like, he was definitely, you know, those Barrera wins gave him a lot of weight at that point. You know what I mean? And people were thinking, like, the super fight to be made was going to be Junior Jones against Nassim Ahmed, you know? And all he had to do was get through Kennedy McKinney at Madison Square Garden. And here's the thing. At this point now, Junior Jones, he's feeling himself so much, and he's at the height of his career, even more so than bantamweight champion, that, like, there was a Ring magazine where they did an article, and he had a hit list of who the guys he was going to fight and who he wanted to beat and everything like that. And it featured Hamed, it featured Daniel Zaragoza, Kevin Kelly. He said they were friends, and after he would beat Kelly, he would take him out to dinner, stuff like that. Vianney Bungu and Kennedy McKinney. And the one he showed the most disdain for was Kenny McKinney. For whatever reason, he didn't like him. You know, I think they both came from the amateur system around the same time. I don't know if they crossed paths back then or whatever, but they did not like each other. There was a disdain. Something was definitely just, they didn't work. And Jones made it very clear that he thought McKinney was a bum. He didn't think anything of him. He thought he was washed, and that any time they would fight, he would destroy him and, like, you know, embarrass him. And he would be glad to do it. So McKinney, to his credit, said too that he didn't think Jones had a lot of heart, and that if he, you know, was tested and had to, you know, really pull out the guts, that he thinks that he was going to knock out Jones. So there was definitely a lot of bickering going on. So you couldn't ask for a better set the stage for Jones. I mean, he's at the height of his career. It's his birthday. I forgot what exactly he was. I think he was celebrating one of his birthdays. And in his hometown, he's at MSG fighting in front of his crowd, and he's fighting his bitter enemy, who he wants to whoop on badly. I mean, like, he thinks everything is set for the most perfect just night ever, and instead it becomes the ultimate disaster.
Absolute nightmare, dude. Absolute fucking nightmare. You know, Kenny McKinney, he'd been through a lot in his career. Like we said, yeah. He was at a point in his career where a lot of people didn't really know exactly what it was he had left. You know, apart from the drug use and whatnot, he'd been through a bunch of wars. He'd been hurt a number of times, et cetera. And so it really did seem like Junior Jones was being served, like, all right, well, you know, like, here's this fighter who's at this perfect time for you, and it's a name fighter, so good luck. And that's what it turned out kind of looking like. But it's funny, and I know he said it in the third round, but I honestly did think it in the first when I was rewatching it. I was thinking, you know, Junior Jones is squaring up for that right hand a lot.
Yeah. Because like, he was going for the knockout. Mm-hmm.
He's going right hand crazy, and he was not being like slick or sneaky about it really at all. And the way that he was kind of like cocking his right hand, you know, like waiting to throw it. And Kennedy McKinney, the problem is that, again, he'd been through a lot. He's already not a super fast fighter. Good boxer, you know, well-polished boxer, good technique, just not super fast with either with his hands or his feet. And so Junior Jones, definitely more of a sharp, slick speedster. You know, it was kind of like they're both boxer punchers, but Kennedy McKinney's got more of the puncher. Junior Jones got more of the boxer. You know what I mean? And so that's kind of what it looks like early. It looks like stylistically Junior Jones is like, he's squaring up a lot, but it's okay because he's got the speed and he's, you know, pop, 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 you know, keeping it pretty sharp and whatnot. And even so, it was back and forth in the first round. It was pretty good.
It was, but you got the sense that Jones still had no disdain for McKinney, and he was looking for a quick knockout. Like, he wanted to have a quick, you know, knockout, birthday, coronation, everything in front of the fans. And then hopefully in a dream world, he would go in the ring afterwards and challenge Hamed after the fight or some shit like that, right? But, you know, after, I forgot what round it was, but, like, Junior Jones at round two just starts revving it up. And, like, the announcers even say it, too. They're like, wow, he's really pushing it. Like, he was throwing a ton of punches. And there's ways to be active without exerting so much energy, but Jones was throwing every on his jabs. Or like throwing with full maximum force that I'm trying to take your head off and I'm trying to knock you the fuck out. Like, I don't have any business. You have no business being in the ring with me. So I'm just going to make this as quick as possible and whatever. And he was doing that. McKinney, like you said, was slow, had been around for a long time and was absorbing a lot of it. But the thing is, one thing McKinney can do besides being a good boxer and having a major right hand is that he could absorb a lot of punishment. He proved that in the Barrera fight. Like, he was a dangerous guy and he could soak it up. So you weren't going to get him out of there really quickly, no matter how much you tried it. And then Jones was just there hitting him, boom, 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 boom. And McKinney's taking it. And, you know, eventually he does go down. Like, he has taken a knee. He was taking a lot of punishment, but he's still doing it. And like you said, every once in a while, he's throwing a counter back, boop, boop, and he's landing it. You know, it's not really stopping Jones's momentum, but at the same time, McKinney is, you know, in his head, he's saying to himself, at least I can still keep on catching him. And then at one point, I think when there was a noticeable turn in the fight, there was a headbutt. And when the headbutt came up, there was a cut under Jones's cheek. You know, and that almost made him start, like, pushing it even more, the pace even more, because, like, it bothered him that he got cut now, you know? And as he's doing that, you just see him. He's getting more wild. He's flailing a little bit more because he's getting tired. Like, he's throwing over 100-something punches around, you know? And, like, everything with maximum velocity. And yes, he's doing damage, but at the same time, McKinney's really not going anywhere. And McKinney's starting to get used to it. And that's the last thing you need to happen. So,
yeah, it was a really bad cut. Luckily, under his eye and on his cheek, but it was deep. It was really deep. Mm-hmm. But like you said, dude, and on top of that, like this was one of the few fights where Big George actually had some good insight as far as what was going on. Instead of like, you know, small punches, da, 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 boom, you know, like that kind of shit, like what they teach you to do in the gym, he was just wham, bam, bam, crash, bash, you know, like just everything he was throwing was just massive. And it sure looked like in the second round and then into the third round, like he was beating Kennedy McKinney's ass, dude. Kennedy McKinney, it sure didn't look like he was going to be able to last very much longer. You know, he was getting whacked around real bad. And I mean, I don't know what it was, but I think it was probably he threw something like 100 punches or 101 punches, Junior Jones, that is, in round two. And then I think they said he threw 103 or 106 or something like that in round three. And it was like
absolute bonehead strategy.
He evidently was not ready to exert that much. And then on top of that, in the third round or in the fourth round to start the round, like you said, Kennedy McKinney, like, I'm not one of those people who believes in like equations when it comes to styles and stuff like that. Like, there are too many variables, but I do believe that timing can beat speed for sure. you know, speed, generally speaking, speed and skills can beat power. They usually do. But timing can beat speed. If you're out, if somebody is much faster than you, you can time them. You can still hit them, even if they're much faster than you. And that's what Kenny McKinney was doing, was he was timing Junior Jones when Jones was getting right hand happy and squaring up. Kenny McKinney was leaning in and bop, you know, just kind of getting him. And then another thing he was doing was they were getting locked up in the clinch, and Kenny McKinney had his right hand free and was bashing him on the temple. Mm-hmm. And that's the kind of shit that will, you know, that'll fuck you up. And it might not seem like it is, but it wears on you. And so in round four, it was like a steady diet of these right hands for Junior Jones. And it was like, you could see the little power meter, like a video game, like with each right hand, it was going, but it was like, he was taking it. And then after a few of them, it was like, he wasn't taking it so good.
Or, dude, you know, if you ever play Fight Night and you're whooping on a guy's ass, but for whatever reason, they won't get knocked out. And you know, like the stamina in that game is really wonky, where like the guy will throw 100 more punches than you, but he only loses 5% of his stamina, where you lose 20% of yours. Yeah. So like by round 10, you're sitting there and you're like, and you're saying to yourself in the game, you're like, all I gotta do is hold up for two more rounds. And then he punches you and you go down, you can't get up, right?
Yeah, and you do the slow-mo, like, rrr, rrr.
Yeah. And then you flow in sections. Like, basically what happened to Jones, except it happened in round four. He was cooked. He had absolutely nothing. And it was one of the most damning just collapses I had ever seen up in that point in the ring. Like, that's how do they describe it when you say the runner reaches the wall? That wall that they reach when they can't run anymore and they just kind of stop and they're dead.
Yeah, they just like hit a wall, yeah.
Yeah, hit a wall. That's what Jones did, you know, the wall being Kenny McKinney's right hand, but like he was exhausted. And it was, and everyone was wondering, like, why would he do that? What was the purpose of that? I mean, in my mind, I think only because like he was in his hometown, he was at MSG in the big room, he was at the height of his career now, fighting a guy that he felt was nothing to him, that he hated. It's his birthday, and he's beating the daylights out of him. And he thought, okay, let me try to get him out. But I mean, all that exertion just blew it. And McKinney just kind of outlasted him.
And it's not unheard of for mm-hmm. a fighter, you know, especially like a featherweight, like level, a featherweight size fighter, to throw 100 punches in a round. Like, don't get me wrong, that's still a lot. Like, and you know, I mean, you're, you know, CompuBox.
Yeah, of course.
But like 100 punches, regardless, is a lot, but it's not unheard of.
But when you're going on, it is maximum trying to
it's,
knock.
It's not off. Like the. It's not just, you know, this kind of shit, you know, on the ropes. But it's just whoom whoom. But also on top of that, you could see another, like talking about the power meter. You could see that he was winging these shots, and Kenny McKinney was wisely just ducking, like bobbing, weaving against the ropes. And Junior Jones was just like, woo, you know, like swinging, missing. And you could just see, like, it was just, he was getting exhausted, dude. He was getting totally exhausted. But then the way that he collapses too, like when they let it go on and then they start pelting. Oh my God, dude. It was a very wild co-feature to start the evening. You know, Kenny McKinney just starts putting it on him because Junior Jones has nothing and he could probably feel it, you know, totally. Like in the clinches, like he's just getting pushed over and shit like that. And he gets knocked down. And so then referee Wayne Kelly, who they even noted at the time, because it had just happened like the year earlier, that Wayne Kelly was the one who disqualified Andrew Galata against Riddick Bowe the first time. And so he lets it go on because he's like, all right, I'm giving you a chance, because Junior Jones is like, yeah, I'm fine. And they go to resume, and Junior Jones, his legs just like give out. Like he just goes blah, 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 and falls forward. Like, and of course, thank goodness he stopped the fight. But I mean, very Vladimir Klitschko, Lehman Brewster-esque.
Yeah.
You know?
Well, absolutely. And that was, and you know what? If Ahmed Kelly didn't happen, that would have been a dramatic enough fight that would have made it a solid show in itself, you know? But that was a huge upset, and that's what, like, catapulted it back to the main event, because now all the cards were, like, you know, unshuffled again. People were expecting Junior Jones to win this and then challenge the winner of the main event fight. Like, this was not what was supposed to happen. So now Kenny McKinney was all of a sudden catapulted back into the limelight, into the forefront. And Yeah, that was like, you know, the momentum happening right there. People were just like, holy shit, you knew you were going to be in for a spectacular night now, because after that happened, I mean, you know, it's hard to even come down from that. But then, like, with the buildup of that and then the main event getting ready to start, people were just like, the excitement level was at an all-time high. So Kelly comes to the ring as we transfer, I guess, back to the main event, right? Kelly comes to the ring and people are hyped, you know, they just. This is his home and everything like that. And I believe this was the first time that he had fought in the main building, in the big house as a professional. Like, you know, in the Golden Gloves final, stuff like that. At least back then, you would fight, which was pretty cool, in the big building at Madison Square Garden. But most of his fights happened at the Hammerstein, not Hammerstein, what's it? The at M the mini MSG.
At
So the
the
Feld.
theater.
Yeah, the theater, exactly. So you know, he felt this was his home. Hamed is invading his home and everything like that. And like, this was the big time. Hamed making his American debut at MSG. I remember they already had a giant billboard out at Times Square when Hamed on it. Like, they were promoting the shit out of this. This was like a big deal, you know? And when his entrance started, like, it was, you know, I already watched a couple of his fights and knew what I was expecting, but I didn't see anything like this. And when the whole thing came out with like the white sheet and it looked like it was gonna be like a fashion show type thing going on, you know what I mean? Like with the runway and everything like that. Like, it was just crazy. It was so cool to see. And then it started lasting long and longer and longer.
That was one thing about his entrances, dude, was that he didn't give a fuck like who he was inconveniencing with this entrance. But I've said it numerous times on different episodes and podcasts and shit like that. And we just mentioned it on the last show. I love the pageantry. I love the ring walks. I love doing that shit up. If it's silly, whatever. Like I love that shit. Because it's like fighters don't have, beyond like the press conferences and stuff like that, fighters don't, they don't have a ton of opportunities to like be unique or show their personality or do something fun or whatever. And on top of that, you know, I think that there's a lot going on. It's stressful. Some fighters are nervous and they have like a pre-fight ritual and stuff like that. So they're not going to be doing anything all that creative or whatever. And that's fine. Like they don't have to. Nobody's going to be being forced to do some crazy shit. But I always enjoy that. I like when they do fun stuff for ring walks. Even like, I know this is gonna sound wild, dude, but Joe Messi. I know the third franchise, our Buffalo guy. But no, he always did like a fun ring walk too. Like I remember one time they did some show in Buffalo and he like started up in the fucking stands and like did a whole like walk down the bleachers and I was like, oh, that's pretty fucking cool. You know, like that'll get you hyped. You know, they do it more, far more in the UK than they do it here, et cetera, et cetera. I won't belabor the point, but Nassim Ahmed always had some cool shit going on. His Halloween fucking ring entrance, dude. I mean, nobody did
I
that
guess.
shit.
Oh, yeah, that was
Comes
amazing.
over, he knocks the fucking skeleton
He looks, he
in.
goes, and then he makes the face again and keeps on walking. I mean, I love
He's a total goofball, but I mean, but I love that kind of shit. But you could tell though, that he like you were saying, it gets to the crowd and it's a needle in the crowd and it's kind of poking at him and like just like, what are you gonna
from what
do?
I've read, though. And I forgot where I read it, but I heard that there was some kind of malfunction. He wasn't supposed to be behind the curtain as long as he was. And from reading that, and if you watch it, you can tell there's a couple of times where he, like, you can see his body language stop from him like really being into it and dancing to him kind of just like, you can see, you know, there's a slight noticeable change where he's like, okay, I'm still going with it, but you can tell he's like, okay, what the fuck is happening here? Like, you know. He's trying to, like, at one point he goes like that, and you know, they're still doing it, and he's like, okay, fine. And then he stops, and he's still, and then he like starts shadow boxing a little bit, but then he's just kind of like looking again, and that's around the point where you're like, okay, like, all right, the thing was supposed to open at this point. Okay, I get it. And then it finally does, and that's when like it expedites a little bit to the ring, but like, yeah. But I mean, it was hilarious. You watch that, you hear the announcers, because Lampley, especially Foreman and Merchant, never really witnessed anything like this. Merchant, who was always like an old school guy and kind of hard to please and, you know, would rumble about a lot of stuff. Actually, he seemed like he liked it. Remember in the commentary, he was like, this is so crazy. I kind of, he was like, it's kind of great.
Well, and they already know, it seems that they, a lot of people already had kind of an inkling of the kind of stuff that he likes to do pre-fight and whatnot. Yeah. So they're like, oh, so what is he going to do when he gets into the ring this time? Is he going to do the flip? Or is he going to do the dip, the slip, you know, all sorts of shit. And of course, sure enough, he flips over the top rope, which I mean,
Kevin Kelly's face.
It's no small athletic feat either with for such like a little guy who the ropes are like, you know, this height, like his head height almost. And he flips over the rope and just runs like right into Kevin Kelly's face and like confronts him to the point where it's just like,
that's he's such a heel
just
move.
Arrogant. Yeah, he did not give a fuck. So you're just sitting there going, oh, I can't fucking wait. I can't wait for this guy to get his head fucking punched, you know?
And you see the referee, Benji Estevez, like when he breaks them up, you see him smirking because he knows he finds this hilarious too. Ahmed's there. And you know what, Pat? What's interesting is that like as they get into it, you can tell they like each other. Like they don't.
Yeah, hate. They're not swinging. They're not like pushing or shoving or nothing.
No, Ahmed's messing with him, and Kelly is like, you know, with it.
Yeah, he's too, like, okay.
The only time Kelly got like really agitated is when it was taking so long for him to get in the ring. And at one point, you see Kelly get on the ropes and he's going like this, like yelling.
Yeah,
and
yelling.
Get your ass in the ring already, like, enough is enough of this shit. And then you hear Merchant, Kevin Kelly wants to get in here and fight.
Yeah, dude. It was, admittedly, it was a. I will say, like, Larry Merchant had his calls where I was just kind of like, dude, I could take him or leave him, but yeah. He did have some great calls, and this was a night where he had a great call, dude.
Yeah, you know, everybody was hyped.
They're getting in each other's face, and like it's pretty good natured and shit like that. But then Larry Merchant, right before the bell rings, he drops a great line. A lot of people want to know, is the prince for real, like he's a real prince, or is he a frog?
Yeah.
It's just the kind of shit that, like, you know, only Larry Merchant could get away with and have it be like actually like cool, you know, like, ah, okay.
And then I think it was Merchant that made like a comment when he first came out about like smoke and mirrors, whatever. And then fucking Lampley drops the egg, he goes, we don't mean smoke gainer. Thanks, man.
Yeah, he had a couple of weird, like, one-line dad jokes on this broadcast that were just like,
yeah, man, you dork, shut up.
I know it's the 90s and you got that bow tie on, but chill, bro. What are you doing?
Exactly. But, you know, so they get in there, they do that, and then, like, you have the entrance, and it's like, you just felt the excitement because they were both in there, and, you know, they were both just really hyped about it. And, like, Ahmed gets in there, and when they do, like, when Buffer announces them, Ahmed has his hands up like that, and he's there, you know, talking shit to Kelly's face. And I'm, like, my excitement level as a kid right now, I'm doing cartwheels in my house. Like, I'm going to hype because I don't know. You just felt it. Like, you just knew this was going to be something special to watch. But we didn't know how special it was going to end up becoming. Like, I favored the prince to win the fight, but I was hoping Kelly was going to be able to exploit him a little bit, but I had no idea what I was going to witness. Because I knew Ahmed's style was so unorthodox, and I didn't know what kind of, you know, Kevin Kelly was going to show up. But I mean, we found out quickly in that first round.
It took, I think it was 2 minutes into the first round or something like that.
Yeah, first off, it was pretty uneventful, no?
Yeah, I mean, I think that you're looking, you could see that Kevin Kelly definitely has a somewhat technical style. He's a puncher, but he's like a boxer puncher. It definitely comes from more kind of a technical upbringing and a good amateur career, like we were saying, and they're kind of just feeling each other out. And on top of that, it's southpaw versus southpaw, which adds an extra level of, and for anybody listening or watching, and they're like, what is that? I don't know, why is that special? If I think that southpaws see a lot of other southpaws in the amateurs, I've heard that a lot. I've heard southpaws say like, oh yeah, in the amateurs you see a lot of southpaws, but in the pros, like, you barely see them. And, you know, it's kind of true, You just go through the list of like the first Southpaw champions from various divisions, and some of them it's like shit didn't happen until like 20 years ago. You know, it's fucking wild. But like, point being, the Southpaw versus Southpaw matchup is a really strange matchup because it doesn't happen that often in the pros. And then on top of that, like, it takes away the quote unquote Southpaw advantage that one fighter might have, where the Southpaw has a different look that they're used to seeing. And the right-hander's like, all right, now I got to figure out weird angles and shit. But then put two Southpaws together, that advantage is nullified. And now all of a sudden you're looking at often a fight where the two guys are locking up weird and colliding with each other and shit like that. And then on top of that, it's usually slow going in the first round. Like, they're like, what the fuck is this? And that's kind of how it looked like at first. So sorry for that little side tour, but sometimes it needs to be said. But yeah, it looks like they're jockeying for position. And then Hamed starts going on the attack and starts kind of winging big punches at him, gets him on the ropes, steps out, and like Prince Nassim Hamed can only do, steps out with his head way up in the air. Like a
hands fucking... all in different directions. And what does Kelly do? Catches him with a beautiful hook. And at that point, too, you got to mention this. The HBO announcers were a little enamored by Hamed. At that, you know, and they were like, oh, you know, Kelly has been constantly can't catch him. Yeah, the Prince is ahead. Oh, he's catching Kelly. He's faster than him. Yada, yada. And down goes Hamed out of nowhere. Because like you said, Hamed leans back in that one way he can do. And Kelly, because he's a smart professional, has jumped in with his own shot. Hamed off balance gets dropped on his ass.
Not even a big shot either. It wasn't even like a massive shot. Just a clean, compact. Just stepped with him, you know, like Hamed kind of steps back and leans back and Kelly just steps with him and boop, puts him down. And it was, you could almost see a look on Hamed's face like, oh, okay. Like, it's going to be a night like that.
And also too, like, oh shit. Like, that's the last thing he needed to do. Okay. I just got knocked in my fanny again. Like, you know, which wasn't supposed to happen. And then I was around that he was controlling, even though like there wasn't a ton of action. Hamed had the general control of what was going on in that round. And when he was going in for a flurry, that's when Kelly caught him, because Kelly punched with him as opposed to just holding, you know, waiting and then trying to counter after that. So that's how he scored that knockdown.
Yeah, it was just kind of a bonehead move. And then somewhat interestingly, Hamed winds up getting up, and again, in just signature Hamed style, looks like he had a tremendous chin. He'd get knocked down and off balance and all sorts of shit, but like very rarely did you see him hurt. You know, like, and he gets up, he's fine, and he's walking Kelly down for the most part for the rest of the round. But still, you know, you got to give that round to Kelly. You know, he caught Hamed hard, and it was an explosive round because of that.
And it was one of those fights after that that you just realized, okay, we're going to, you know, we're in for something special tonight, or we hope so, because that's going to embolden Kelly. You know, a dude like him, how he fights, and if he scores a knockdown, that's going to get him hyped, and it's going to make him, you know, fight a little bit more excited. And you got to think of his corner too. He had a trainer by the name of Phil Borgia, who made for a lot of dramatic moments in the corner, because if Kelly's eyes were getting swollen and all that, Borgia was from the type of school of, like, you know, a Teddy Atlas or Emmanuel Stewart, for example, where he wasn't going to be like very, you know, calm and mellow and try to, like, you know, relax with you and try to like guide you through this. No, he was going to yell at your ass to get you like, what the hell is going on? Yada, yada, yada. Close. Hey. Like, you know, Borgia was one of the OGs of it, because Emmanuel Stewart, we didn't see him lose it. The first time I saw him lose his cool was with Darnell Nicholson, which was actually around the same time of this. So, okay. And then Teddy Atlas, same thing. So I guess all three of them, yeah, this was around the same time where trainers were starting to get more, a little bit more exasperated in the corner like that. But Borgia was not the type of dude that was going to be like, mellow, okay, you know, like Andre Ward's trainer.
Yeah.
Virgil Hunter. Yeah Virgil, he's going to be like a cat, you know, he's going to be like a whisperer over there and try to, like, you know what I mean?
Although, to Phil Borgia's credit, he wasn't getting up in George Foreman's face trying to fight him either.
No, he wasn't.
And Teddy.
Jesus Christ. Shut up and get me a sandwich.
What are you thinking?
He's lucky that wasn't 19. Imagine if that was 1974 George Foreman.
They were talking about
him by his head right there, just picked him up like Zeus and no holds barred and just flung him across the room.
They were talking about Teddy had a bad chin back when he was a fighter. at much lower weights. So, yeah. I mean, like, let's not put him in with George Foreman now.
He's lucky, you know? George was all, like, you know, super religious at that point and very much mellow and happy and, like, you know, the guy that did commercials for Pizza Hut and donuts and burgers.
Yeah, good gravy. Back you almost lost your life that day, Teddy. Anyway, back to the fight.
Well, back to the thing, but no, you know what I'm talking about. Like, Borger and Kelly, they both made for, like, an interesting dynamic because they would be yelling at each other in the corner, you know, like, hyping each other up and all that. So, yes, after that first round, everything was all heightened. Like, you know, you're like, oh, shit, this is going to be a real fight. Kelly is, like, coming to fight tonight. Hamed just got clipped. Here we go.
Yeah, it absolutely no question. And then going into the second round, you know, everybody's hyped. The crowd's getting into it and whatnot. And then sure enough, they're getting back into an exchange and Kelly clips Hamed in a really strange way, like a really weird angle to where Hamed almost like turns around, you know, like, and his gloves touches the canvas. But it's Benji Estevez is a little bit late getting in there calling the knockdown. And so Hamed rises back up and Kelly goes whap and just gets him actually a really hard shot too, which in my opinion was just like a yet another testament to like Hamed had that chin, dude. He didn't even see that punch at all, like nothing at all. And it was like rah, like his head totally snapped around and he was like nothing happened. And Kelly was a good puncher too. It wasn't like he was just some fucking softy.
Yeah, absolutely.
So, but yeah, that winds up getting called a knockdown. And man, at this point, it's like, yo, what did Hamed get into?
I mean, this was going to look like a disastrous debut on U.S. soil. And this is what everyone was hoping for. Oh, yeah, Hamed's a fraud, yada, yada, yada. But soon enough, you know, the power that, again, you know, I'm not sure how many people.
Larry Merchant, thus far, we haven't seen Nassim Hamed's power. 2 seconds later, boom.
Boom. And Kelly, and that was a legit, like, the two knockdowns that Kelly scored, like you said, they're more flash variety. The first round knockdown, like, it would look dramatic, but it was still a flash knockdown because Hamed was off balance. Second round, like you said, this one that Hamed scored was not a flash knockdown. This was, like, the power where you were like, oh, shit, you know.
Yeah, like, stopped him in his tracks and sent him back, like, whoa.
Mm-hmm.
Like, and you could even see on Kelly's face, like, he shook it off really well. Like, he was like, all right, you got it. You know, that was good. But you could see, like, he was like,
okay, yeah, the power's legit.
Oh,
yeah.
Damn, okay. But, I mean, but it also kind of livened him up a little bit, you know. And on top of that, another thing that we both missed was that, funnily enough, there was that moment right after that because Kelly got in his lick after Hamed already was down, and then he hit him again. And then so Kelly gets knocked off balance and into the corner. Benji Estevez doesn't do anything. So Hamed comes over, goes bap, and fucking hits him while he's helpless in the corner. You know, so it's like almost, it was like he was saying, like,
yeah,
got you, bro. You know, so I mean, it was obviously heating up.
People are getting hyped about this now, you know, like, oh my God, this is getting crazy. So round three starts and Kelly ends up boxing one of the most disciplined rounds you could find, like, of his career. You know what I mean? It was almost like you saw a preview of how Barrera would end up boxing Hamed in, you know, 7, 8, 9, 2, like 5 years later or whatever it was. And it's like, Hamed in that round, there was no knockdowns in that round. You know what I mean? There was a knockdown for a second, but like,
yeah, it was the only kind of calm round.
But what was interesting about that round was that Hamed, that he looked awkward in that one. Kelly was so disciplined, and Kelly was not a dude who we both mentioned. He could stay disciplined easily. Like, you know, it didn't take him much for him to, like, lose his cool and just go into war. But after getting dropped, I don't know what it was, but, like, he decided, okay, I'm going to do that. And as he said, disciplined, he outboxed Hamed that round. Hamed looked awkward. He looked off balance. As he always did, but, like, this one especially because Kelly was being so disciplined.
He looked like he was kind of out of his depth there for a moment. Yes. Like, it was like, oh, damn. And now because he's outboxing him?
Because Kelly decided, you know what, I'm not going to get caught with some shit this round. I'm just going to go. And he boxed beautifully that round. And Hamed looked befuddled. And I remember watching that too. I'm like, wow, man, I think Kelly might be able to pull this out. But Kelly being Kelly, he's just one of those guys, he can't just compose himself. If he had kept himself composed, who knows? I mean, it's always his chin kind of gave out, his eyes, whatever it may have been, you know, later rounds and stuff. But that third round showed him what he could have done had he stood disciplined. But of course, round four happens.
And it was, dude, he can't help himself. Kevin Kelly was before anything, he was a fighter. You know, I mean, like he definitely was well schooled, but he was a fighter. And even he said, you know, he's coming in to entertain, you know, it's his hometown, the Flushing Flash. You know, he was coming in to put on a show. And so he thought that he, I guess, could press his advantage in round four and winds up getting clipped. And it's one of those knockdowns where, like, anytime you see a fighter and it's like they lose control of one of their limbs, because
mm-hmm.
Kelly goes down and it's like his arm's like under him and it's like pinned under him. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, anytime you see a fight, it's like they're hurt, because then that means like something disconnected. And, you know, like Montel Griffin gets knocked down by Roy Jones Jr. and he tries to get up and his ankle's like spasming and he's like, bap, it's like flipping around, you know, like flipping around and shit. That type of shit.
Or if you like see a guy like Terry Norris or Larry Holmes, who Holmes ended up winning the fight, Norris didn't. When they got up from their knockdowns, Holmes against not Terrell. Not Ernie Shavers. Who's the guy that knocked the shit out of him? Ronaldo Snipes.
Yeah.
Holmes against Ronaldo Snipes or Simon Brown, Terry Norris. When they get knocked down, they get up and they run headfirst into the ring post.
Yeah.
They're so discombobulated still. Like, yeah, not even walk, they just walk. Boom, they just...
Yeah, like Robinson Graciano, and Graciano's sitting there pedaling the bicycle on the ground for like 5 seconds. Yeah. Like, something ain't working. You know, something is not connecting right. And that kind of shit. And so Kevin Kelly gets knocked down and it's like his arms under him and he like rolls over, but you could tell like he's hurt, you know.
And that was a short punch. That wasn't like some long extended punch I might hit him with. That was like one of those just douche, you know.
It's extremely clear that Hamed, he does have that one punch power.
Yeah.
And he has the fight changing power, because he's in a bit of a rut. Like, yeah, he managed to knock Kevin Kelly down earlier, but at the same time, it's like, you know, he just had an entire round where he had a tough time finding Kevin Kelly, and now he's not looking so good, and he needed that knockdown and got it. But and then in his zeal of going after Kevin Kelly gets clipped, and he's so off balance that his glove touches the canvas. So it's like,
and that was one of those, it was such a flash knockdown that Hamed clearly looks annoyed by it.
Yeah, he's like, okay, just like, really don't even. Again?
Yeah,
he's mandatory eight, like, come on.
Yeah, you know, and then they go back, and it was just, but I'll tell you this too, like Cedric, you know, when I worked for Cedric, it was only he and I. And so like he would tell, you know, when he wasn't so busy, he would actually like stop and just randomly tell me stories sometimes. Or if I would like pick his brain enough, he would like sit there and want to talk, you know, do it. So he co-promoted the show because he promoted Kevin Kelly, right? And he was telling me how he was sitting next to Lou ringside for the fight. And, you know, they're obviously
how wild was Lou going?
Well, that's what I'm getting to. They were like close, like brothers and everything like that. But he said, Cedric told me, he was like, when Hamed dropped Kelly for the first time, Lou jumped out of his chair, like going crazy. And Cedric kind of looks at him like, what the fuck, Lou? Like, you're right.
That's my guy.
Yeah. Like, I was just like, really?
That's fucking
like,
hilarious.
Like, you're just gonna do that in front of me, bro? Like, okay.
And Lou's fucking stomping around red-faced. What the fuck? Fucking doing Lou DiBella things.
Just all hype because Hamed was, you know.
That's awesome.
Yeah, I always thought that was really funny. Because, you know, Cedric was hype, and Cedric never got excited like that. I could just picture him when Kelly probably dropped him. His eyes just probably got excited. You went,
ooh. And one final, and like that one final kind of hurrah for Kelly too, where, I mean, it wasn't a hard knockdown whatsoever. It was definitely a flash knockdown. Prince wasn't hurt. It was total balance.
It was still, it just added.
But
to
it was still just was like, what? Oh, yeah, you know, still. Okay. But then, you know, I think that final knockdown from Hamed, that left hand, you could, the issue is that if you watch the sequence more than once, it's like, you could see it. He sees it. Hamed sees it. Like, he's zeroing in on it. And so Kelly's kind of lurching forward and Hamed's just sitting there. He just has it, just waiting for it. Bap, one left hand. And you could see Kelly's legs just,
yeah.
That's it. That's it. And I guess they could. He could have let it go because it was he was really close to getting up at 10. But it's like, why? You know what I mean? It was clear, I think, at that point that Hamed's power is just way too much. But, dude, what a fucking four rounds.
And considering what you just had on the undercard, dude, people were just, I mean, that would be the type of card that I wouldn't be able to go to bed that night. Like, I would just be so buzzed if I was there watching that live. But that made the Hamed aura. Like, that's what he needed. Even though he got dropped three times in that fight, struggled, you know, went back and forth. That made his legend because people wanted to see him again. Like, you know, you can get knocked down. You can struggle. You can look like shit. But if you would legitimately knock out your opponent and kind of live up to the hype of having that power and everything like that and the explosiveness making it such a wild brawl that, and, you know, you have to be seen again. And that's what Hamed was at. People were just like, oh, my God, I need to see this again. Everybody wanted to see it again. And it's crazy to think that, like, out of all four fighters that night, none of them really reached the heights of what they reached that night again, because like Hamed still had look, out of all the guys, Hamed had the best career still. Like after that, like, you know what I mean, he was in major big fights after that, but he never really reached that magic that he still had. You know, think about it. After this fight, he fights Wilfredo Vasquez. Vasquez was past it, and Hamed, you know, kind of picked him apart and stopped him in an easy fight, right? And then that's when, like, the performances really started looking shitty and spotty for him after that. Because after that one, soon after, I'm not even looking at his record, but I think it was, like, Wayne McCullough soon after. He goes the distance of that fight and doesn't look, you know.
A lot of people were kind of whining about that. Because, I mean, McCullough had a granite chin, but a lot of people were like, you know, it's the end of the road for McCullough, so what the hell, you know.
And Hamed was bigger than anything, and it was just a weird, you know, whatever. The Cesar Soto fight is one fight that no one ever needs to ever see again. Like, that was just ugly, ungainly, everything. And then, like, he has entertaining fights with Paul Ingle and Augie Sanchez. But should he be struggling with guys like that? You know? No. He shouldn't be struggling with a guy like Paul Ingle, who he should have blasted in two rounds. He shouldn't have gone, like, a fucking to hell and back with Augie Sanchez for five rounds before he stopped him. You know, his only really impressive fight after that was, like, Vuyani Bungu, who we found out later on was kind of past it himself. But it's like, you know, the Hamed that we always believed, that we're like, oh, man, you know, he's going to do X, Y, and Z. It never really happened after that. And soon to find out, if you listen to, like, all the European, you know, the UK writers and everything who were very closely aligned with Hamed and his camp back in the day, they would have told you he peaked before the Robinson fight. He stopped giving a shit after that. Like, everything was just kind of, like, on his pure skill and instinct and athleticism that he was kind of just going through the motions, you know?
And that's another thing that we didn't really mention was the fact that he had gone through several trainers, including Emmanuel Stewart.
Right, yeah.
And over the course of his career.
After Bringo,
he went to Emmanuel
Stewart. He went to the late trainer who passed away, who he stood with most of the time, the Spanish guy. He became Acelino Freitas' trainer as well.
Oh, yeah. No, he's Puerto Rican, Oscar Suarez.
Yeah. Oscar Suarez, exactly. And there was that thing, too, that this Suarez and Stewart were co-training him, and they're both, like, bickering because they were trying to...
Yeah, it was...
You can never be a co-trainer for a guy when you're trying to, like, fight, you know what I mean?
And especially not a guy like that. You know what I mean? Like, that's already the personality's too big, and then you're adding more and more and more. It's not... It never works well. And yeah, I mean, that's a good point. You know, none of those fighters ever really, well, specifically Kennedy McKinney. Kennedy McKinney never really had a big win after that. Junior it's Jones.
Crazy, you know? Pat, like, I don't, you know, think, all right, because remembering back then, I still have a specific memory of what fights were supposed to happen after this card. There was a lot of things happening. You know, I mean, like, there was all the articles in the magazines, newspapers, everything. People were talking. You know, and this
from 122 to 135, HBO had a number of fighters, dude.
And they wanted to mix and match these guys, all right? So, like, after this card happened, you know, I remember it was mentioned in magazines and, again, in newspapers, like, because we didn't have this wasn't the age of internet. There was no Dan Rayfield or all of these guys who were breaking news or trying to do whatever the fuck it is. You know, it was just, we're reading on hearsay for this shit. And at one point, HBO was going to have a card that was going to be Nassim Hamed and against Kennedy McKinney, and the undercard was going to be Arturo Gatti against Kevin Kelly. because you're almost thinking, like, in their mind, they're thinking, okay, two action warriors, let's match them up. And then McKinney knocked out Junior Jones, so match him up with Ahmed. Sure. Sounds good in theory, but
Yeah, there's a lot of
probably
funky
would have got
weight
it.
stuff going on
Yeah,
in
just.
that, and
And
I don't
then
know how you do that, dude.
at one point, Ahmed was supposed to fight Gotti, and then Gotti ends up losing to Angel Manfredi. So that fight falls apart. Kenny and McKinney subsequently never really builds on that big win over Junior Jones. And in his next big fight, fights Luisito Espinoza, who, interestingly enough, has probably been around longer than any of those guys.
Yeah.
Buck somehow
Talk about
didn't.
long in the tooth. Yeah.
Buck somehow just, wasn't as worn out as the rest of them. And it absolutely blows out McKinney, just knocks the shit out
Man,
of him.
but between like him and Jerry Penulosa, like, dude, you got to watch out for those washed Filipino fools. They'll take
Seriously,
you
man.
out.
Those guys, yes. Like, especially if they've been like warmed up and haven't been in a long war for a while. Yeah.
Take your ass out, bro.
Seriously. And
For
that's
real.
why McKinney. So, like, McKinney's career never reached those heights again. Hamed, we just said, like, he obviously still had a lot of big name fights, but where he was at the Kevin Kelly height, it never quite got there again. And then it faltered until he finally lost to Barrera and yada, And then with Junior Jones, same thing. Like, he never, it was sad to watch because I always loved Junior Jones, and he was one of those guys you wanted to root for. But he still got a few big fights after that. Like, he fought Eric Morales, who came on the scene right after all this kind of happened. And same thing, he shot his load after, first three rounds and ends up getting knocked out. And he just never really recovered after that. He had a couple of big fights, most notably against it was Paul Engle, who we just mentioned. I think that was on the undercard of fucking Lennox Lewis, Michael Grant, or something. But anyways, that was a good fight. That was a really fun fight. But Jones just, he faltered and he never really reached the potential where he could have been at. And then Kevin Kelly, after the Hamed fight, same thing. He still had big fights. Somehow ended up getting a pay-per-view fight against Barrera, which is one of the worst pay-per-view main events in history, and got an HBO main event against Morales. But he just, he never really reached those heights again either. So,
Yeah, Marco Antonio Barrera was a massive star, so they're trying to push that on the back of Barrera being a star, but it was like,
but against guys like,
what are
that
you
made
guys
no
doing?
sense. Like, why would you put Marco Antonio Barrera, Kevin Kelly? Like, if you want to make that like a $20 pay-per-view or some offshoot shit, fine, whatever. But they put down an
Strange.
HBO pay-per-view where they expect you to pay $50 for that, or
Yeah.
Barrera Mazzanchi Fana. Like,
Oh,
what
dude,
a
they
weird.
had. I believe it or not, I don't think I have it anymore because I'm pretty sure I gave it to somebody. But I had a Barrera Kelly shirt for the longest time. So, bro, they had shit printed for that. So I'm saying, yeah, they went well beyond putting on
And this is like
pay-per-view.
when Kevin Kelly was washed, like washed.
Yeah, it's like a several years after this Hamed fight in which he was already starting to kind of like, is he washed? So, I mean, dude, I will say Kevin Kelly though, and one thing I haven't heard from in a while, and I could be wrong, maybe he's doing local shit in New York, but he did commentating for a number of different guest commentating spots. I always thought he was super fucking good.
Yes. Absolutely, man. Kelly could talk his ass off, and he's always been able to talk. And he's a great analyst. And like, he can break shit down, man. Some of those former fighters that, there's not all of them, some just aren't made for that, but like, there's a few of them out there who are just really, really good analysts and could break down what's going on in the ring. And Kelly is probably one of the best of them. And unfortunately, for whatever reason, he was one of those guys that I think, well, I can't say he never made it to the big league, because wasn't he the analyst for KO Nation? And
I think
when
that
it
he
first came
was
out,
for, I don't know if he was permanently, but I know he
but
was on it.
him and Fran Charles were like two of the originals. So I mean, yeah, he deserved. Like, I would love to hear him back on commentary again. And if you ever meet Kevin Kelly, he will talk your ass off in a good way. He's one of the most personable,
He
nicest like
seems like a
people
super nice guy, yeah.
is. And he's been in so many wars, and he loves to talk about his career. He's one of those guys that's not going to be like, oh, yeah, that was a good fight, huh? No, like, he will sit there and he'd be like, hey, man, talk to me about Derek Gant. Talk to me about Hamed, Alejandro Gonzalez, anything. He will sit there and talk to you for forever about it. And like, what a wonderful human Kevin Kelly is. I can't say enough about the guy, seriously.
Man, I'm still in disbelief even after we've talked about it that it's 25 years, bro.
It's incredible. Incredible, man. We've been around a long time, man.
Ay, ay, ay. Little too long, but man, hey, dude, it's like I like to thank you for doing the homework, but like on this kind of thing, it's like not much homework, dude. It's fun. It's fun to rewatch.
This is just something like this is just my life. This is something I was passionate about as a kid, like reminiscing about this and hopefully getting everyone like bringing it back their memories and reminiscing about this shit too.
Rewatch 1990s fight. Somebody twist your arm, you know?
yeah, seriously.
So. Force you to fucking do it. No, dude, I do appreciate it though, because reliving is always fun. And, you know, your enthusiasm just adds on to mine and it builds and it's great. It's a lot of fun, dude. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Absolutely, buddy.
Thank you, everybody who listened in. We appreciate you. If you listen in on the podcast app, please subscribe and give us a rating or review, leave a comment, those kinds of things. Very much appreciated. If you watched on YouTube, hi, hello, thank you. And subscribe there too as well. And if you would leave a comment or reply, we'll try to get back to those. We appreciate those. On social media, the Knuckles and Gloves podcast is on both Facebook and Instagram, but it's on Twitter as well, at least as long as Twitter is around. And we're also individually on Twitter. Mm-hmm. Ditto, as long as Twitter is around. So Eris is on there as Punch Zone Eris. Me, I'm on there as Patrick M. Connor. So say hello and talk soon, Harris.
Have a good one, y'all.